You're listening to WORT 89.9 FM, Madison.
Do you find yourself provoking conversations with your friends and coworkers? Are you a strong listener? Then you should consider applying to become the next host of A Public Affair, WORT's daily hour-long call-in talk program. We're now accepting applications for this volunteer position. The next host will be the voice of Tuesday's show and join a stellar lineup of folks who engage listeners in conversations on social, cultural, and political issues of importance every day of the week. We're looking for someone who is curious and well-informed, comfortable speaking on air, someone who can think on their feet, and has at least 5 hours a week to prepare and host the show. To find out more information or apply, go to WORTFM.org/talkhost.
Welcome to Worldview, your weekly source for news and analysis from around the world, right here on community-supported radio, WORT 89.9 FM.
Good evening, and welcome to the Sunday, April 27th edition of Worldview. I'm Lee Rowe, and I'm your host. Later in the program, we have the founder and executive director of the Rohingya Mayufwinor Collaborative Network, Jasmine Ulla, speaking with Gil Halstead and Amitabh Paul about her life and working with and for Rohingya women in Canada, the U.S., and in Southeast Asia. That will be at about half past the hour. But first, we have the news.
Humanitarian aid agencies are alarmed by recent funding cuts by major donors led by the United States and other Western countries as they prioritize defense spending. Internal memos sent to UN agencies for food and refugees are raising questions about how to maintain hunger relief. The UN High Commissioner for Refugees, or UNHCR, Chief Filippo Grandi, sent a note to staff last week saying it planned an overall reduction in costs of 30% and that the number of senior positions would be cut in half. He said that some country offices would be closed and covered through multi-country bureaus. The World Food Program warned last month that 58 million people are at risk of extreme hunger or starvation unless urgent food funding and aid arrives. Millions of people are facing acute food shortages in Sudan could be affected. WFP Director Stephen Amolo said that the cuts were necessary due to the unprecedented funding environment, with a 2025 donor outlook at $6.4 billion, or a 40% reduction from last year. Amolo said, quote, "We remain concerned that the situation shows no sign of improving," unquote. The WFP said in a statement to Reuters, quote, "In this challenging donor environment, WFP will prioritize its limited resources on vital programs that bring urgently needed food assistance to the 343 million people struggling with hunger and increasingly facing starvation," unquote.
The Economic Community of West African States, or ECOWAS, will be 50 years old in May. Established in 1975 by 16 member states, its initial focus was economic growth and regional trade and cooperation. But within 3 years, it expanded to encompass political, security, and other objectives as the West African post-independence governments responded to socioeconomic and security challenges. Despite inevitable upheavals during 5 decades of post-colonial nation building, ECOWAS can look back on some important successes in integration, peace and security, and good governance. The organization has most often employed diplomatic tools, less visible than high-level delegations and official statements or sanctions. ECOWAS' involvement in mediation efforts has ensured the organization's overall relevance and justification in the face of unconstitutional changes of government. The failure of the soft diplomacy mechanisms is the biggest crisis to face ECOWAS with the withdrawal of Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger, which tests the organization's ability to withstand future crises. ECOWAS has championed democratic values of equality, freedom, justice, pluralism, tolerance, respect, and public participation. The 50th anniversary provides an important opportunity for introspection and genuine institutional reform.
Indian and Pakistani soldiers have exchanged gunfire for a third successive night across the line of control, which separates Pakistan-administered Kashmir from India-administered Kashmir. These serious measures are the result of tensions between the nuclear-armed rivals after a deadly attack on tourists in Kashmir last week, in which gunmen killed 26 people, most of them Indians. India has accused Pakistan of carrying out a terrorist attack. Pakistan denies it. A previously unknown group, the Kashmir Resistance, claimed the attack. It was the worst assault targeting civilians in years, and tensions have risen dangerously between India and Pakistan, which have fought two of their three wars over Kashmir. After the incident, India suspended a crucial water-sharing treaty and closed the only land border crossing. It revoked visas issued to Pakistanis starting today. Pakistan retaliated by canceling visas issued to Indians, closing its airspace to Indian airlines, and suspending trade with India. People from both sides began heading to their home countries through the border near Pakistan's eastern city of Lahore on Friday.
In the past year, Japan has seen the retail price of rice more than double, prompting extraordinary action to help increase the supply and bring the cost of the important food staple down. The monthly imports of rice for February exceeded the import volume for all of the 2023 fiscal year, according to the Agricultural Ministry. The Japanese government is also taking the unusual step of releasing rice from its strategic stockpile to help meet demand. The current shortage of supply is seen to be the result of many factors, including a heat wave in the summer of 2023, which reduced domestic production. A large increase in visitors since the pandemic is also seen as part of the problem. Nobuhiro Suzuki, a professor of agricultural economics at Tokyo University, thinks rice production targets set by the government are also part of the problem, saying, quote, "The real root of the issue lies in what I'd call a policy failure. Cutting production too much and leaving farmers unable or unwilling to grow rice without doing anything about it. That's why it escalated into such a major problem," unquote.
A 6.3 magnitude earthquake struck just off the northern coast of Ecuador on Friday, injuring at least 20 people and displacing families in the city of Esmeraldas. In a post on X, newly elected President Daniel Noboa pledged to set up shelters, provide humanitarian aid to those affected, and, quote, "assist with everything our people need," unquote. The operation of the country's primary crude oil pipelines, SOTE and OCP, was temporarily suspended following the earthquake. The decision to pause operation comes just 1 month after a landslide ruptured the SOTE pipeline, spilling 25,000 barrels of oil into Ecuador's river systems. The Esmeraldas refinery, Ecuador's largest, with the capacity to refine 110,000 barrels per day, was also closed for inspection as a precautionary measure. State-owned oil company Petroecuador stated that despite the closures, national petroleum export would not be significantly impacted. Authorities are working to repair damage to the city of Esmeraldas and restore power to multiple neighborhoods so the displaced families can return home.
Argentina declared 7 days of national mourning following the death of the first Latin American pope and Argentine native Pope Francis. Formerly the Archbishop of Buenos Aires, named Jorge Mario Bergoglio, Francis was beloved by many for his commitment to helping refugees, migrants, and the poor. After he was elected to the highest office in the Catholic Church, Francis never returned to visit his home country. Although some criticized his decision not to return, others defended it as a necessary measure to avoid his presence being used for political purposes. When asked by the press, Francis never provided a reason for not visiting Argentina during his 12 years as a pope, but those who knew him say he cared very deeply for his home country and always paid special attention to current events there. Despite the controversy, Francis' heritage and nationality were a point of pride for many in Argentina and all of Latin America. Following the announcement of his death, Archbishop of Buenos Aires, Jorge Ignacio Garcia Cuerva, said his parish were, quote, orphans of a father who profoundly loved his country and had to learn to become the father of the whole world, unquote.
The Palestine Liberation Organization's Central Council on Thursday overwhelmingly approved the creation of a deputy chairman of the executive committee, currently chaired by President Mahmoud Abbas, a first since the organization's establishment in 1964. The official Palestinian news agency explained that the deputy will be chosen by the members of the executive committee upon the president's nomination and the approval of its members, who have the authority to appoint or dismiss the nominee. The executive committee consists of 16 members, three from the Fatah movement, six representing six factions, and seven independents. The creation of the position paves the way for a potential succession mechanism for President Mahmoud Abbas. The vice chairman of the executive committee becomes vice president of the state of Palestine, while the presidency of the Palestinian Authority remains subject to direct elections in accordance with the basic law. Hamas criticized the move, describing it as, quote, deepening division and perpetuating autocracy, unquote, and renewed its call to rebuild the PLO on democratic foundations and hold comprehensive elections. Hamas stated that unifying the national ranks and the liberation project depend on the inclusion of all Palestinian forces within a unified leadership framework.
Amnesty International on Thursday condemned the Algerian authorities for what it called an escalation of repression in the country over the past 5 months, particularly against an online protest movement. The human rights NGO reported arbitrary arrests and unfair legal proceedings. Algeria has arrested and sentenced at least 23 activists and journalists, particularly for their support of the online protest campaign Manish Radi in Arabic, which translates as "I am not satisfied" in English, launched in December 2024 to denounce restrictions on human rights and difficult social and economic conditions in Algeria. This crackdown in February 2025, which particularly criticized the swift measures that did not allow many of these individuals sufficient time to properly defend themselves, coincided with the sixth anniversary of the pro-democracy protest movement in 2019. In one of the incidents, an 18-month prison sentence was handed down in March for publishing information likely to harm national security or public order. And those are our headlines for today. Now here's Gil with our first longer story.
Qatar brokered talks last week between delegations from the Democratic Republic of the Congo, or DRC, and the rebel group M23. Their smoldering conflict had broken into open combat in recent months, with the M23 capturing the major cities of Goma and Bukavu in the eastern region of the DRC. This conflict has created one of the world's largest humanitarian disasters, with more than 7 million people displaced, including 100,000 who fled their homes during the fighting this year, in which some 7,000 people were killed. The Qatar talks ended Wednesday with a declaration of the parties' intent to work toward a ceasefire and discussions on the root causes of the conflict. DRC President Felix Tshisekedi had refused to meet with the Rwanda-backed M23. But in March, Qatar brokered a surprise face-to-face meeting between Tshisekedi and his Rwandan counterpart, Paul Kagame, during which the two leaders called for a ceasefire. While the final declaration from last Wednesday's meeting was the first positive news about this conflict in years, it should be remembered that there have been a number of discussions and agreements over the years, none of which have been adhered to. The wild card this time is the signing in Washington on Friday by the DRC and Rwanda of a pledge to work toward a peace deal that would enable U.S. access to critical minerals in eastern Congo. The parties will present a draft peace deal by May 2nd and refrain from providing military support to armed groups. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio also signed the agreement as a witness. Based on the agreement, the U.S. is in talks to invest billions of dollars in minerals in Congo, which has immense deposits of tantalum, gold, copper, cobalt, and lithium, all used in mobile phones and electric cars. The U.S. and Rwanda are also said to be discussing a minerals deal. A red flag was introduced when it became known that Eric Prince, founder of the notorious private military company Blackwater and a close ally of President Donald Trump, is brokering an agreement under which he will oversee the security and taxation of mineral extraction in the DRC. Congolese civil society activists and government critics have questioned whether such a deal would even be legal, not having been considered at all by the DRC Parliament and National Assembly. Kambale Musavuli, a Congolese analyst, said, quote, "Legal experts are now debating whether the president even has the authority to make such sweeping deals unilaterally," unquote.
Vice President J.D. Vance spent 4 days in India last week for trade talks with Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi. His visit also included discussions about the two countries' military cooperation. Both countries are part of an alliance dubbed the Quad, which also includes Japan and Australia, and is a counterbalance to China's power in Asia. The trade agreement between the U.S. and India under discussion has a target of more than doubling the trade between the two countries to $500 billion by the year 2030, considered an ambitious goal for them. Part of the increase in trade will be achieved by opening India up to American agricultural imports. On April 18th, India's largest farmers group, the Indian Kisan Sabha, or AIKS, asked all of its chapters to launch a Vance Go Back campaign as part of their opposition to elements of the trade deal, which could hurt India's already stressed agricultural sector. On Monday, farmers across the country took to the streets ahead of the vice president's arrival to protest his visit. The AIKS statement said in part that Vance's visit, quote, "is a part of putting pressure on the state of India and the corporate-led ruling classes to surrender the national interest to facilitate windfall profiteering to the multinational companies," unquote. Farmers were joined in the protests by working-class Indians who also see the trade deal as harming small to mid-size Indian businesses. The AIKS statement said, quote, "sectors like generic pharmaceuticals, Tuat auto parts, and millions of workers across these sectors are going to be adversely hit," unquote. Vice President Vance's public remarks on the trip also included a pitch for getting more advanced U.S. weapons into India's army, including the newest version of the stealth fighter, of which he said, "the F-35 will help protect your people like never before," unquote.
Salvadoran President Nayib Bukele proposed a prisoner exchange last Sunday for 252 Venezuelan migrants expelled by the U.S. that are currently held in El Salvador's prisons. In exchange for the incarcerated migrants, Bukele asked for the release of the same number of political prisoners held by Venezuelan President Nicolas Nicolas Maduro's regime. The proposed exchange has been criticized by the Venezuelan government as a cynical and tyrannical act of human trafficking. On Monday, Maduro demanded that Bukele, quote, provide proof of life for all the kidnapped young people, unquote, and to allow the families and lawyers of those held in El Salvador to visit the prisons where they are being kept. Most of the migrants held in El Salvador on behalf of the U.S. are accused of involvement with violent gangs such as Tren de Aragua and MS-13, now classified as terrorist organizations. However, few have received any form of due process, and neither the U.S. or El Salvador have provided substantial evidence to back up those accusations. Nelson Suarez, the brother of one of the detained migrants, stated, quote, first they were supposedly alleged terrorists, now they are no longer terrorists, they're part of a political exchange, unquote. Adeles Ferro, a Venezuelan-American activist who runs an advocacy group called the Venezuelan-American Caucus, is one of many voices calling for the release of both the illegally detained migrants and Venezuela's political prisoners without the need for an official exchange. In a statement addressing the proposed exchange, Ferro said, quote, what he's trying to do to negotiate innocent Venezuelans back and forth with the Maduro dictatorship is despicable. We cannot celebrate two authoritarians negotiating back and forth with Venezuelan lives, unquote. Maduro and the Venezuelan government have condemned the offer and given no indication that they would consider moving forward with the prisoner exchange.
Farmers in the Brazilian state of Bahia are using innovative new farming practices aimed at revolutionizing the production of cocoa in areas where the crop is currently not known to grow. Historically, Ivory Coast and Ghana have been the top producers of cocoa, with over 60% of the world's stock grown in the West African region. Due to a mix of plant disease, climate change, and aging trees in the region of in Africa, has now seen a steep decline in cocoa output for three consecutive years. With high demand and dwindling supply, cocoa prices have surged, nearly tripling in 2024 alone. As far back as 2019, farmers in the state of Bahia saw the cocoa shortfall coming and recognized it as an opportunity for Brazilian farmers. Moises Schmidt of Schmidt Agricola was one such farmer and began planning for it with a 10,000-hectare farm worth over $300 million. Schmidt spent the last 6 years developing a line of high-yield cocoa trees, and it intends to implement new approaches to farming the crop. Allowing the trees to be cultivated much more densely than the traditional farming practices used in Africa. As multiple large-scale cocoa farms are under development in the region, Schmidt believes the Brazil's cocoa production could rival that of Ivory Coast and Ghana in the next 10 years. However, according to Corina Perez Grombacho of the Brazilian Agriculture Ministry, the biggest risk to these innovative operations is caused by a lack of biodiversity. Each tree planted on the giant farms is a genetically identical clone, leaving the crops vulnerable to disease, a problem that has faced Brazilian cocoa farmers in the past. In the 1980s, Brazilian cocoa production was devastated when a fungal infection known as witch's broom swept through the region. But Schmidt remains confident that the risks can be effectively mitigated. If these massive cocoa-producing farms proved to be successful, it would mean a huge influx of money to the Brazilian economy and could help stabilize the price of cocoa worldwide.
Iranian state media reported today that the death toll for the explosion at the Rajai port near the southern Iranian city of Bandar Abbas had risen to 40, with approximately 1,000 people injured. Iran declared a national day of mourning for the victims. Iranian President Masoud Pezeshkian visited the site of the explosion and offered his condolences to the families of the victims and wished a speedy recovery to the hundreds of injured, saying, quote, I came to see firsthand whether there is any action or issue that can be followed up and discussed with the government, and we will make every effort to care for the families of the victims who lost their lives, unquote. A large part of the fire has been brought under control, and efforts are continuing to contain the remaining 20%, according to the head of the Red Crescent Society. The Saturday massive explosion, quote, felt like an earthquake, unquote, according to residents in the surrounding area. Rajai Port is one of two ports on the northern shores of the Strait of Hormuz. It covers an area of approximately 2,400 hectares and has a capacity of up to 70 million tons of cargo annually, about 85% of the total loading and unloading operations carried out in Iranian ports. After the explosion, the Iranian government warned against any, quote, speculation before completed investigations, unquote. According to a private security firm, the port did receive a missile fuel chemical in March as part of a Chinese shipment of ammonium perchlorate. The chemical is used to make solid propellant for rockets, and improper handling of the solid fuel could have caused the blast. The blast and subsequent fires happened just as Iranian and American negotiators met Saturday in Oman's capital, Muscat, for the third round of talks over Iran's nuclear program.
Iraqi Minister of Culture, Tourism and Antiquities, Ahmed Fakak al-Badrani, delivered an invitation to the new Syrian government to attend the Arab Leaders Summit in Baghdad on May 17th. If President Ahmed al-Sharaa participates, the Baghdad summit will be the first regular Arab summit that al-Sharaa has attended, having participated in an emergency Arab summit on Palestine in Cairo on March 14th. Last December, Syrian factions extended their control over the capital, Damascus, after taking control of other cities, ending 61 years of Ba'ath Party rule, including 53 years under the Assad family. By January of this year, the new Syrian administration declared al-Sharaa president for a transitional period scheduled to last 5 years. Syrian Minister of Culture Mohammed Yassin said, quote, Iraq and Syria are linked by a civilization that spans thousands of years, and we are brothers living on the same land. Artificial borders will not separate us. We are one people who share many common characteristics, unquote. Baghdad is preparing to host the summit amid pressing Arab issues, foremost among them the ongoing Israeli war of genocide against the Palestinian people, which has now reached its 19th month. And that's a wrap of the news from around the world for Sunday, April 27th, 2027. I'm Lee Rowe.
I'm Neil Adams.
I'm Gil Halstead, and it is cold in the studio.
Yeah, it is cold in the studio. Sources we used to prepare today's stories were Al Arabiya, Al Jazeera, All Africa, Anadolu, the Associated Press, the BBC, CNN, The Conversation Africa, the Institute for Security Studies, IRNA, France 24, The Guardian, Macau News, The Middle East Monitor, The New York Times, People's Dispatch, Reuters, and Sana.
Welcome to the April 27th edition of the Worldview feature. I'm Gil Halstead. I'm your host. And today I'm joined, as I often am, by my colleague Amit Pal, who is the communications director for the Freedom From Religion Foundation here in Madison. And our special guest today is Yasmin Ulla, who is a Rohingya feminist, author, a poet, and a social justice activist born in the northern Arakan state of Burma. known as Myanmar. Her family fled to Thailand in 1995 when she was a child, and she's remained a refugee until moving to Canada, I guess maybe about 15 years ago in 2011. Yasmin, thanks so much for finding time to join us.
Thank you for having me.
We should also add that you are the founder and executive director of the Rohingya Maya Phoenor Collaborative Network. It says a women-led, Rohingya-led, and refugee-led organization working on Rohingya human rights issues, education, translocal solidarity with a focus on women, peace, and security, as well as intersectionality framework. I was fortunate to meet some of your colleagues here in Madison last week, about 10 days ago, it seems like. Several women who came and spoke at an event that I was at, and it's the first time I learned about the amazing work that you and the other women at the Collaborative Network are involved in. So thanks so much for finding time to speak with us. And I am going to turn it over to Amit to begin exploring more about what you and your organization do.
So Yasmin, if you could please start with a bit of background about the Rohingya community. In November, a good friend of mine, Mong Zarni, who's been very involved with all this, was on our show, also speaking in good part about the Rohingya community. But for people who missed that interview and have not really kept up with what's been happening, could you please provide a bit of background about the Rohingya community in Myanmar and what's happened with it?
Sure. For the Rohingya, we've had to basically undergo a systemic repression and oppression for the past 82 years, coming into 83 years. It started and began right around the time that we were trying to seek independence from the British colonial empire. And that was in 1942. There was a lot of political turmoil within the region, not just as a country, Burma, Myanmar, but among many different ethnic groups. And unfortunately, we, you know, because we sit in such a strategic place, since the military junta, 1942 onwards, there was already a lot of issues that started, but it wasn't exacerbated to the point of genocide being made in that process. Right around 1962, when the military junta came into power, that was when it really was exacerbated to that point. And this is not just about a group of people being killed en masse. It is strategically done not only to dispossess land and resources from the Rohingya community, it is also to set an example and to push, similar to how the Overton window is pushed here between the right and the left. Over there, it's the dictator and, you know, someone that's tolerable. And for the military junta, what they did was to use the Rohingya as the example or as a slaughter, you know, animal, as a scapegoat for all the problems that they've caused for, you know, decades and decades of mismanagement and corruption. What they've also been able to do was instilling policy and practices that discriminate against Rohingya to the point that the intent, the only way that we can interpret it as a community, is that the end is annihilation of the Rohingya. Yeah. And what happened was 2011, 12, 2016, 17 onward to this day, the military still has a very, very repressive view of Rohingya, and continuously so try to use different tactics and, you know, practices to ensure that, for example, Rohingya don't have access to villages. Arbitrary arrest happens on a daily basis. Sometimes the military will draw arbitrary borders between villages or water sources or anything that Rohingya would need to access on a daily basis to ensure that life is disrupted. On top of that, there's constant looting of Rohingya farmers. And because we've been extremely discouraged and cut from the education system and at any other basic necessity that a government would provide, we've had three lost generations of children who've not had any at all, you know, access to literacy program or any kind of training or any educational opportunities. And these are, you know, the military government or the authorities that have come in to ensure that those, you know, opportunities don't happen for Rohingya. Rohingya have turned into an agrarian society. We've been farmers and fishermen for a long time, but there are no other aspiration that we can achieve. And this is basically Arakan state, even though we live alongside with other ethnic communities like the Rakhine, the Mro, the Khmer, and many other groups. The Rohingya have been targeted for the most part to basically use as a testing ground to see how far the military can push the international community, to basically see how much the international community will ignore the plight of the Rohingya. At the same time, they're also testing this to see how much they can justify the killings of the civilians within the country, while also blaming the Rohingya as a scapegoat. So strategically, there were so many different things that Rohingya land were basically sitting on: natural gas, many, many different kind of mining opportunities. There was a lot of coastal destruction, you know, sand mining, mangroves cutting. A lot of these can directly connect to other climate change issues. But of course, a group of people are being annihilated en masse because they're being displaced to make way for a special economic zone that was determined and dedicated by the properly elected civilian government of Aung San Suu Kyi. And this was, you know, obviously designated by her government, while also it displaced the Rohingya and enabled the military to further push 840,000 Rohingya to leave in 2017. And over 20,000 people have died. At least 8,000 women were impregnated by the Myanmar military junta. So there is a very, very clear sexual and gender-based violence being used as a weapon of war. Many cases that actually was recorded and made into exhibition by Greg Constantine in collaboration with the U.S. Holocaust Museum. The exhibition is still there today. Yeah. On the Rohingya plight, on the Burma's path to genocide. I really highly recommend everybody checks it out. It's actually online as well, so you can check out some of the survival stories. It's not just stories of people who ran away and left and, you know, are now living in Bangladesh. These are going deeper into what the community have done to not only keep each other alive, but also hold themselves, you know, together, while also keeping their children alive and keeping their culture alive. So these are very, very important testaments that we need to bear witness
to. And there's been a refusal by the government, regardless of whether they're civilian or the junta, to even nominally recognize the Rohingya as part of the Burmese nation, hasn't there?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that was the one tactic, and I think a very clear tactic that has been internationally and widely recognized was the 1982 citizenship law. It was not categorically denying that Rohingya didn't exist, but it was to slow down census process and, you know, population survey. So Rohingya does not have access to these things. It was not digitized at that time, right? So people would have to travel there. If you close off the entire region and militarize it, securitize it to such an extent, and people are being controlled to the deepest level in marriage, in education, in access to hospital, another kind of basic necessity, you have now a population of people who've been so weakened. And whatever you do to them, to ask them to basically give up their citizenship or give up any kind of identity card that they have, they're going to do it in order to be able to access some of those basic necessity. And so what happened was, since 1982, Rohingya who used to have passport or national registration card, which is basically a document that recognized Rohingya as indigenous to Burma, Myanmar. And the term is very, very important because the idea of the founder of Burma, Myanmar, or, you know, the people who came up with the constitution, only recognized the Rohingya or, you know, any other groups because they existed prior to 1820. The Rohingya, in large part, have already been documented by, again, you know, we have the bad side of the colonial impact that we've had to, you know, live through. But there was also a good side to this, and only one that I can recall, which is Dr. Francis Buchanan. He wrote down in his diary while he was doing the survey with the British East Indian Company prior to the colonization. He's a Scottish physician. He came through, you know, and surveyed the area, obviously wrote down a bunch of maps and surveyed the languages that are spoken in that region. And he found out that there was such a people. He called them Muhammadan, which is the followers of Muhammad. Again, these are, you know, early uses of names, but basically it means Muslim. And he said, these people actually speak Rohingya. And he recorded some of the terms that were used in that language. To this day, the diary still exists in England, in the museum, I believe. And that is, in the library. And that in and of itself actually very much underscores our existence for a very, very long time. And we consider ourselves indigenous to Arakan. But the military has done a very good job at erasing our existence and pushing these narratives, you know, after 1982, completely cutting us out of the access to having proper documentation and being legal citizens. People from that generation onward, from 1982 onwards, including myself, don't have access to any proper documentation. We're considered stateless by a lot of definitions, but it is not us that are stateless. It is the government. Yeah. It is the state that has made us stateless, even though we've had a very, very clear connection to the land historically and even today. So all of this is to say that the usage or the weaponization of documentation is very, very real, not just to use it as a pathway to, you know, deny our rights to vote or to participate in elections or, you know, any other aspect of nation building, but it is also done to ensure that Rohingya land will be dispossessed easier. And I think there's a lot of parallel that we can draw here with many other, you know, genocides that are happening around the world. Land is so, so important to indigenous communities, and land is the first thing that is taken away from people because it represents so much more to us, but it only represents revenues and profits for, you know, some of these perpetrators.
We're speaking with Yasmin Ullah from the Rohingya Mayafoinur Collaborative Network here on Worldview. We're about halfway through the program right now, and we've still got a lot to learn about what's going on with the Rohingya and with the diaspora of the Rohingya. And I thought I would ask next, Yasmin, if you could talk about the origins of your organization, of the Rohingya Mayafoinur Collaborative Network. When did it get started, and what's its main purpose and activities right now?
I'm happily going to speak about that. Rohingya Mayafoinur Collaborative Network, first of all, is a collective of Rohingya women who are experts in their own rights. I myself have been working as an advocate for the community in the past 8 years or so, coming into the ninth year of doing this since 2017 onward. I realize that there is a lot of gap when it comes to women's representation and women actually participating very actively in ensuring that our voices are heard, but also that the atrocities that happen to us are not erased and that we are part and parcel of the peace process if there was any to be brokered. But unfortunately, first of all, we're only brought into the conversation from time to time when it comes to talking about sexual and gender-based violence, which is not the only thing that we can contribute, right? When it comes to other topics around, you know, peace process, nation building, what needs to be done to ensure that education is at the forefront and Rohingya children are receiving that and Rohingya women are also, you know, getting the equalizing opportunities, we don't see as much of that being done by our counterparts, unfortunately. And, you know, people outside of our communities don't see us as much. And so that becomes a barrier of its own. So what happened is that I realized, well, if there's just so few of Rohingya women out there, let's create a space where we can actually train and pass on the knowledge, pass on the wisdom. I know that I'm still young, but, you know, not so young anymore. The young women that you have met, Gil, they are the next generation of women who will be able to do this work. They were also displaced. We've had similar journey where we were all displaced in Southeast Asia. We've had to leave home. We've been cut from our roots, which is, you know, in Arakan. And we've now had to relearn our own culture, language, and various other life experiences that we would otherwise have, and connections that we would have to our own land. And RMCN, or Rohingya Maya for Now Collaborative Network, is a space not only to train these young women, but to pass on the baton for the race that we don't know where it would end, but also to ensure that we uplift the Rohingya community to the best of our abilities, not just through the lens that, yes, we do need to support people on the ground, but there are roles that diaspora can play. There are a lot of experts in our midst, and a lot of these young women have had bachelor's degrees, some masters, some on the path to become something even bigger than that. And I think that that is a picture that a lot of people need to see beyond the victimhood that you see online. If you go search online today of what Rohingya women look like on Google, there would barely be, you know, Rohingya women holding a mic in a doctor, you know, gown or something that is less victimizing. It is weakening our position in the community, in the world, and it actually does not provide people who want to help us the idea of what could become, what could be, you know, our future. And that is the picture and the sort of barriers that we want to get past. So we come back to our community to rebuild, to help, to aid, to assist in whatever way we can, because we have passports, we have some relative safety, and we have some kind of immunity when it comes to going to these different regions where governments are difficult to speak to, and our own community on the ground will face retaliation if they do speak up on the conditions that they're living through. So we're using our privilege and, you know, the positions that we have in the society to ensure that our people are not forgotten and that we can actually continue to do this work long term.
You mentioned, Yasmin, about special economic zones and investment in the state of Arakan, where the Rohingya are from. Are there any particular governments that are heavily involved in this? And is there motivation just to side with the Myanmarese government, just business, or are there geostrategic interests also?
Well, very, very big geopolitical actors are Russia and China. And of course, I think that when we think about the Cold War, we only think about, you know, USSR and the Americans, right? But I think there's a re-emerging trend similar to that, where, you know, there, well, in the past, the US and the West, the neoliberal West, are trying to race to these developing worlds, as they call it, to extract resources. And this is a race against China and Russia. Unfortunately, China, prior to 2011, was starting to build a project called the Jiaohu Deep Sea Port. And because that area, if you look at the map, the Kunming Yunnan, the southern central part of China, is landlocked. And so there is no access to the sea. Where is the access to the sea? Bangladesh, India, and Myanmar. Who is the government that's the easiest to actually convince to create a pathway for them to actually get out to the sea, to create these economic hub for imports and exports? Well, it's Myanmar. When the government is so corrupt that they're willing to actually line their pockets however they want, even if it's filled with blood and bloodshed, you know, they were able to do that because the Rohingya have already been so criminalized and so victimized for a long, long time. It's hard to not say that this is not strategically done and intentive. The Chinese government came in, built that deep sea port, and built a pipeline all the way from Jiaohu port to Kunming Yunnan state and other states in China. And you know when the projects were completed? Right around January or February 2018, when mass number, 90% of the Rohingya were actually driven out of their own homes. And those areas that they were living on were completely blazed and bulldozed to the ground. So there is no longer a, you know, remnants of Rohingya existence on those lands. So that means that the government, civilian government, and the military junta has already sold those lands prior to people actually being kicked out for years on end, because the project started since 2011. And there were environmental activists that protested against it. But because the military junta has a psychological warfare department, they've sown this the seed of hatred between two communities, which is Rakhine and Rohingya. And thus, you know, rumors spread about Rohingya doing X, Y, and Z, and the protest stopped. So these are how people, communities in various developing, you know, developing quote unquote worlds are being pit against one another to ensure that profits are being prioritized over human lives.
So this is a divide and conquer strategy that
very colonial.
And sadly, it appears to have worked, or has worked so far. And you and your organization and others are trying to deal with the results. And you're talking about the diaspora. One of the things that your organization has been involved in is visiting some of the members of that diaspora who are in different parts of Southeast Asia now. But still, aren't the majority of the refugees who were driven out still in Bangladesh? Are you in the, like the women I met, kind of a minority in that diaspora or not? I don't know. That's the question.
Yeah. So Rohingya are actually quite widely spread throughout Asia Pacific. There are 400,000 Rohingya, for example, in Pakistan. Many hundred thousand more in various other countries. There are also Rohingya in Kashmir. I find out new information every day of where Rohingya have basically been displaced to. And the curious thing about Rohingya is that we also adopt and adapt to new lifestyle, new places. And because we have such a pan-Pacific face, we're able to fit in almost everywhere. And, you know, like myself, I go to Malaysia and Indonesia and people don't bat an eye. They might hate Rohingya. And because there's, you know, a backdrop of hate speech that's being basically spread throughout the region, but they see me and they see, whoa, this is another Southeast Asian person. The issue is this. In Southeast Asia, there are about nearly 300,000 Rohingya. 200,000 in Malaysia and about 7,000 in Indonesia. These are new groups of people who've just arrived post-2017. There are about 40,000 Rohingya in Thailand, and these are just estimates of what we know of. And a lot of them are in detention center. A lot of them are being incarcerated for various different arbitrary reasons. But in Bangladesh, the issue is that because of the dwindling funds, parents are actually starting to get scared of the future for their children. And because the funds are not available for people to actually, you know, have access to proper basic necessity like sanitation, food rations are being cut to, you know, from $12 to $10 to $6 per month per person.
Wow.
That cannot buy a pack of noodles, you know, on the side of the world that we live in. And people have to, women in my community have to manage so much of the restrictions that are placed upon them as refugees, you know, after leaving their own homes, dealing with the grief of loss of their parents, their children, their families, their loved ones, and their homeland. And now they're living in a shack made with bamboo stick and plastic tarp with terrible circulation. They can cook, but the breathing is going to be so difficult. I sat in one of those tents many, many years ago, and I was like, I cannot do this long term. But they're living there every single day, day in and day out. One bathroom, for example, is being shared by 10 families, and so much more now because there's less and less of those availability of basic necessity. Now, the reason why we do go back to Southeast Asia is because it's not because Bangladesh is not important. It's so vast. We are a small organization and we understand our own assessment that we will not be able to solve a problem for over a million people right away. Mm-hmm. Where we can focus our energy with our language capability, I can speak Thai, my fellow sisters can speak Bahasa and Malay and many other languages of the region. And so we're making ourselves useful by connecting with people on the ground in those countries with the language that they understand. On top of that, Southeast Asian countries are actually the biggest enablers of the junta through assets management, through natural gas and oil, oil and gas in general, because PTT, which is Thai company, and Petronas, which is Malaysian company, for the longest time was actually a business partner of the military junta. Not until post-coup that they had started to, you know, explore other options and try to, you know, showcase that they've stopped. But who knows? You know, these connections are far deeper than we can see. A lot of them, a lot of the deals happen behind the closed doors. And the thing about Southeast Asia is we see a lot of the mimicking and the reproducing of hate speech against Rohingya that are being imported from Burma, Myanmar, you know, that led up to the genocidal campaigns, which later on becomes a full-fledged, you know, killings and whatnot. We're seeing the same languages being used in Malaysia and Indonesia, and we're scared. We're really scared that collective understanding and collective responsibility is not going to happen. What we're hoping for while we work in Southeast Asia to raise awareness, to interact with the public and to engage policymakers while also bringing the arts and culture component and reviving of those of our own culture for people to see is to reemphasize the collective responsibility that everyone in Southeast Asia has, because everyone in Southeast Asia has, you know, one way or another, been benefiting from the genocide of the Rohingya. Again, genocide is profitable, but not, it's at the cost of Rohingya lives and perhaps at the cost of people, you know, moral cost to Southeast Asianers. But then who, you know, who gets to line their pockets? It's the power elites and the military junta.
I wish we didn't have to leave it there, but unfortunately we do. We have reached the end of our program for today. I want to thank Yasmin Ullah very much for joining us and really giving us an in-depth look at what is happening with the Rohingya in Myanmar and in Southeast Asia. So we look forward to speaking with you again. Hopefully the next time we speak, we can talk about some progress that's being made and about the projects that you're working on. So thanks so much for joining us. And Amit Pal, again, thank you so much for being here and taking part in the conversation.
Thank you so much, Gil. Always a pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
And that's Worldview for this week. Thanks so much to our guest, Yasmin Ullah. And we wish her all the best in her advocacy and activism. We'll post links to the Rohingya Women's Collaborative Network on the WORT website along with the interview. Thank you to the Worldview Collective members, Neil Adams, Sabia Tia, Chuck Benish, Andrew Karn, Gil Halstead, and Amitabh Paul for bringing international news to WORT listeners. And thanks also to WORT News and Public Affairs Director, Shali Pittman. And we especially thank you, our listeners, for listening. Please join us next week for a new edition of Worldview here on your community-supported radio, WORT 89.9 FM Madison and WORTFM.org, or on the app. And now, stay tuned for Salamat.
Worldview is written and produced by a collective of volunteers. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can also contact us here at this station if you're interested in joining our collective to bring world issues to the airwaves. Worldview can be heard every Sunday from 5 to 6 p.m. on WORT 89.9 FM.
Attention, comunidad, community. Knowing your rights isn't just important in these challenging times. It's essential. The ACLU and other regional organizations like Voces de la Frontera remind everyone. If ICE or law enforcement stops you, stay calm. Do not run and do not open your door unless they have a warrant signed by a judge. You have the right to remain silent and the right to refuse consent for a search. If you're detained, don't sign anything without speaking to a lawyer first. You have the right to call an attorney and request an interpreter. And remember, regardless of your immigration status, you have rights and the U.S. Constitution protects you. Spread the word, save the Voces de la Frontera hotline, 414-465-8078, or visit vdlf.org. Always carry a Know Your Rights card and be prepared. Visit aclu.org/knowyourrights for resources in English and Spanish. Stay informed, stay empowered, stay safe. This is WORT, your community radio station, bringing you the necessary information. Stay tuned, stay aware, and protect your rights. Information is power.